This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 73. Brought to you in association with Archover, Smart Pension and Synchron. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Adam French, co-founder and UK CEO of Scalable Capital, the fintech investment management firm based in the UK and Germany. Long-term listeners will recall my tale of a financial news conference on the impact of fintech on investment management back in 2015. There was only one fintech so-called disruptor there on the main stage, and amidst much talk of disruption, very little sign of it. Later in the day, Gren Manuel, the editor, rather hit the nail on the head when he asked why, with near zero fees, ETFs, exchange-traded funds into which we dived in LFP 058 with Laurent Cassis, what can be disrupted if ETFs can be bought for roughly zero commission from Charles Schwab, and thus investment management is already near free? This is an argument I've yet to hear gainsaid amidst the tsunami of hype and bullshit surrounding that uber-American term robo-advice. As was highlighted in LFP 069 on real financial advice, we're about as far away from getting robo-advice as we are from being policed by robo-cops. Perhaps, though, few do take the kinder insider-known-only ETF route, but more will, like me perhaps, do the old-school index tracker funds from the likes of Legal & General, although with total annual fees there of around 0.8%, there's some fat to be shaved. Another line beloved of PR and over-enthusiastic, wet-behind-the-ears fintech journalism is democratisation. I won't waste this time in your ears by deconstructing how undemocratic a world we live in, well, outside somewhere like Switzerland, but as we heard last week in LFP 072, too many folks not just don't own assets but are in debt in the first place. And secondly, to take this one example of LNG, like most unit trusts, you can buy it in pretty small amounts anyway for the last few decades. So, for example, they have a regular savings scheme at £50 a month. How much more democratisation does one require? All of which is broadly correct and may help to explain why fintech, IM, is further behind the curve than many other sectors of FS with respect to being undermined by better, faster, cheaper. However, progress is eternal and incumbent investment management continues to manage trillions and charge high fees for underperformance. So there is a market to be had. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Adam, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So, as I always do before these things, I normally try and find some sleaze on my guests, something to hold over them. And I didn't find any sleaze about you at all, sadly, actually. But you obviously are managing your staff very well. But I was told that I should ask you about sausages. Now, as this is an Anglo-German company, I thought I was being wound up, but it turns out I'm not being wound up, and it's actually not your sausages.
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny story. My wife is opening a sausage restaurant at the moment, and on a pretty much daily basis, I'm either going to sausage tastings or I'm bringing sausages into the office for the staff to take home and eat. So it's a bit of a running joke at the moment.
And she's not doing this as a sort of satirical dig at your colleagues in Germany.
Who knows? Maybe, maybe.
Well, if she is, you're not responsible for her under the modern law. So when you say sausage restaurant, do you mean it serves just sausages? There's one near Bank, isn't there? A German bratwursty, sausagey, proper sausagey thing, where you get these sort of huge fat things.
Yeah, I don't think I'm allowed to say too much in terms of the direction she's going.
Oh, it's a stealth sausage at the moment.
Yeah, it's a stealth sausage. She'd kill me if I said too much. But it's coming soon.
It's a sausage coming soon to a factory near you. So talking about the German angle then and going back through your career background, you once had a proper job with a very blue chip firm that produces all sorts of treasury secretaries for all sorts of presidents. And then one day you either went insane or came to your senses or something in the middle and left all that. But you were saying that a part of that, you were actually at the same conference I was talking about where Gren suddenly woke up and wondered why he was having the same conference.
Yeah, that's right. I think actually we briefly met that day. And that was one of the first months where I actually started my fintech journey. So I quit my job at Goldman Sachs in the back end of 2014. And I think that conference was in Q1 of 2015 where we met. And I'd spent 7 years there working on the trading side for an equity derivatives group who provided retail distribution products for European financial services firms. And as part of that team, three of us actually left to found Scalable Capital. And it was an interesting group because it wasn't just about being a market maker and doing risk management, but it was about providing a full service. And during the time I was there, we were a desk of 12 individuals doing thousands of trades a day. And we scaled that up to tens of thousands of trades a day. And it was 4 employees running that. So I saw firsthand how technology was being used in the institutional space to disrupt my own job. And it was, you know, my love of technology in that group and, you know, the way I've been brought up, that I just wanted to get more in touch with this whole fintech world and try and bring the technology angle into my professional life as well.
So did you go crazy or did you come to your senses, or you're not sure yet?
I think more the senses. The future is clearly going to be powered by technology. At the time, it wasn't that obvious, and I thought it was a big risk that I was taking. But now I'm so happy that I left and so happy that we're going on this fintech journey together. And, you know, the people that I quit with, I'd worked with for a long time. Florian, one of the founders, he actually lived in my house for a year when he came to London. So he was trying to find his feet because he was working for Goldman in the Frankfurt office to begin with. And we quit and we joined forces with an academic. So we brought a professor on board to bring the academic angle into how we shape the business.
And in terms of the business, there appear to be lots of sort of CEOs, and you've got this kind of rather like Anglo-Dutch Royal Shell. You've got sort of dual managements in Germany and the UK. How did that come about? Why did you launch first, or was it kind of simultaneous?
So the plan was to launch in Germany and the UK at the same time. And the idea was that we wanted to have a business that could scale across Europe. So we put in a license application with BaFin in Germany, and we put in a license application with the FCA in the UK. And we hoped that we would get both licenses at the same time and we would launch both businesses simultaneously. It didn't work out that way. BaFin came back after 6 months and granted us the license. FCA took closer to 12. I think that was German efficiency prevailing there. And so we launched the German business first, but the UK business was ready to launch for when we got the FCA license.
It's interesting, actually, because the other distinction, I mean, we're much more American than European these days, especially in sort of Brexiting times. The other distinction, of course, is that if you read the newspapers around fintech and all that, you'll read that the sort of FCA is wonderful, it's got sandboxes, it's here to help, and all this kind of propaganda and spin. I'm not saying this all false, but it's certainly amplified. And you'll hear that sort of, oh, those German regulators, they're so high-bound and hideous and worrying about all the I's and the T's. So it's a nice perversity to hear that in that particular case, BaFin came across the line first. So, well, let's go back in time before all this fintechy stuff existed. And my memory goes back to the 80s of fund management, which was the least glamorous part in those times of a merchant bank, although Warburg's in terms of Mercury Asset Management started to break that down in terms of the value on the fund management businesses. Schroders being another one, it ended up being far greater than all the sort of so-called sexy stuff like corporate finance and all that kind of thing. But back in the day, there were no benchmarks, which made it much easier to be a fund manager, and everybody claimed to be top quartile, something which still sort of continues in VC. Everyone says they're a good VC, but the average VC is poor. I've never yet met a VC that says, do you know what, our performance is rubbish. Everyone's is good. And going back to those times when benchmarks came in, all that kind of stuff, you had these things called closet indexing, which is people wouldn't go very far away from it. And then you had explicit indexing, as I mentioned, and all that. But going back into the past, or maybe into the present, what kind of assets under management are there globally in the fund management business?
Really hard to stick a tangible number on it.
That's why I asked you. You see.
We need to ask another expert. I think it's an order of magnitude, 100 trillion or so.
So lots and lots.
Lots and lots. In the UK, in the private wealth sector, so, you know, money which is managed by wealth managers, it's approximately £1 trillion. But when you start to look in pension funds and institutional money, that number is an order of magnitude, you know, 5 to 10 times higher.
So it's absolutely a vast sum. We were talking before, or speculating before, about what percentage of the world's 7 billion population has money with an investment manager. And of course, that's quite hard to pin down because you'd have to define the terms. So lots of people have exposure to pension funds, but they may not experience it as being sort of their money. And they certainly, as individuals, let's say you're working for Shell, I mentioned Shell before, as individuals in the Shell pension fund, you don't really have the ability to sort of tell Shell to go and change their fund managers or not do their in-house or whatever. But what would your guess be at what percentage of the world does use traditional investment management?
Yeah, I would think, thinking about the developed world, where there's actually a financial industry where you can go and seek either financial advice or money management, we're still talking about the top 1% of people that are actively engaged with an intermediary who's directly managing their money, you know, not through, like you said, a pension fund or so. So it's still something for the very, very wealthy only.
Yes. So moving on to the problems of traditional investment management, which I think are relatively well known, so we don't have to cover them in too much depth. As I was saying earlier, I'm very suspicious of all this sort of democratization word, but there's some idea implicit in this, which is that being the client of a private bank was some wonderful thing which somehow entitled you to riches which were being kept from the 99%, whereas pretty much all of my experience in the last 30 years has been that if you haven't been a client of a private bank, other than missing out on a few good lunches, you've probably been sort of better off. So how do you see the problems of traditional investment management? I mean, for me, it's simply they charge fees and they demonstrably subtract value on average. Therefore, it ain't a good deal. And to me, that's not the kind of thing I'd want to democratize, as it were. I'd want to protect the 99%. There's got to be some way of getting their own back at the 1%.
Yeah. I think you've completely touched the main topic there. It's all to do with fees. We like to say that investment management's one of the few businesses where you get what you don't pay for. Because every pound that you end up paying in a fee is money which isn't working in the market. So if you're expensive, you're already behind. And, you know, catching up is impossible over the average. And that's why you see the underperformance. But the other problem which we see is that even if you do get access to a private bank or to a high-end wealth manager, you're going to have your money bucketed into one of five standardized model portfolios, which, you know, your and my money would be bucketed together and it would be managed in exactly the same way.
Well, I think my debts would probably cancel out your profits from Goldman Sachs, actually. So it would end up being zero to manage.
But what's funny is when you speak to the private banks, you realize that they're actually offering this model portfolio world for most of their client base, and especially for clients that have less than 5 million. And only when you get to 5 million plus do you really get a full bespoke offering, which is crazy. If you were to think you've got a few million sitting in a private bank and they're basically saying, you know, you can go in portfolio 3 out of 5 with, you know, the other 1,000 clients that have the same risk tolerance.
So it's a bit like people feeling they're getting a tailor-made suit and it's dressed up to look like it's tailor-made, but in practice it's Marks and Spencer's and there's 5 sizes. And the gentleman or lady who measures you up when you go in there is taking all of your measurements and then says, oh, yeah, you want a medium, sir. But she doesn't say that. She says, oh, we've got just the thing for you, sir.
It's a good analogy. And then I think you wear that suit to go to dinner 4 times a year with the wealth manager, and that's essentially where your fees are going.
OK, so going back to the 2015 conference, this was all the kind of context that they were talking about then, and it was not long after 2014 when fintech was going to change the world and Citigroup would go bust as a result and yada, yada, yada. And we've had McKinsey say relatively recently that banks are going to lose 40% of their revenue and 60% of their profits. And I'm still waiting to see any of this. So why hasn't much changed? We'll come on to later how scalable is going to change it and all that kind of stuff. But why has this vast and bloated subset of financial services, which is demonstrably charging high fees and subtracting value, why is it still large and bloated like a sort of dying whale on the beach?
So I think you've got two themes coming into play. The first is banks aren't going to go away tomorrow. They've got huge distribution power. You know, in the same way that I don't have millions of clients and therefore I can innovate and I can create something for a niche customer set, they have millions of people that they can create something and just immediately offer to them. So they're in a really powerful position. Even though they're sitting on antiquated technology and their processes are very heavily dependent on the core infrastructure, which is 20, 30 years old, we can't get away from the fact that they can just market their propositions way better than we would ever be able to do. But the second thing as well is that the investment management solution isn't a viral product. You know, I can't go out there on the streets and make this sound as sexy as something like Snapchat or Facebook or Uber. So you have to really resonate with a small group of people. And it's my belief that the original wave, and I like to kind of think that we're right now on the second wave of digital wealth managers, that original wave was trying to target the mass market too much. And at the end of the day, the mass market don't have a wealth management problem. They have other problems. You know, it's to do with budgeting and saving.
2 weeks ago, Squirrel on the podcast, and I think Emmanuel said that, you know, the average savings in the UK, so that's the average, including all the ultra-rich, was £500. And, you know, for the sake of argument, the bottom 50% of the population have got debts, not assets in the first place.
Of course, they've got a completely different problem set.
Yes.
So I think trying to create a wealth management solution for those people...
It's like trying to democratize Ferraris.
Exactly. You know, there's a reason why Ferraris are expensive. Not everyone can afford them. In the same way that wealth management... I love the idea of democratization, and I think that every firm who's trying to achieve this is doing a great thing, but it's really hard to get to scale by targeting the mass market.
Yes, and as I was saying earlier, I personally feel that... Starting in the 1970s, these things called unit trusts went a long way to do that. So you can put a tiny amount of money in the unit trust if you pick the right one, and the fees are no longer outrageous. Again, going back to the 80s, I managed the Eurobond fund, and if you put a tiny amount of money into the Eurobond fund, it was a 5% front-end fee, which took quite a lot out, and then whatever it was, better part of 1% per annum and all that kind of stuff. Nevertheless, of course, because I was managing, it was a brilliant investment, and you would have made gazillions out of it. But over time, these front-end fees have been eroded and all that kind of stuff. So in terms of a market to disrupt, it's going to be quite hard to disrupt, you know, for the sake of argument, legal and general tracker funds or just buying some ETF that replicates the FTSE All-Share thing, because that's out there.
Of course, and at the end of the day, even if you were to become a client of Scalable Capital, you're buying financial products, or we're buying them on your behalf, should I say. So we still use ETFs as the building blocks for our portfolios, because they're just fantastic products to get you low-cost, globally diversified portfolios. Where the difference is between what you get if you were to buy a tracker fund or an actively managed fund or an index tracker or an ETF is that you're getting a service on top of it. So it's basically trying to differentiate the service element of what we're trying to deliver and the personalization of what we can achieve with technology versus just buying, you know, a financial product off the supermarket shelf. And that was starting to be achieved through the first wave of robo, you know, going back to 2014.
You've used a rude word there.
I hate it as well. I much prefer digital wealth managers. Funny enough, actually, we were talking about robo-advisor internally the other day, and it came from the US. And there's a lot of confusion in the UK about this term because there's not a lot of robo with a lot of robo-advisors, and there's also no advice being given.
Apart from that, it's a perfect phrase.
Yeah. but the difference between the phrase in the US and here is that a financial advisor in the US actually can manage your investments. They have the ability to place trades and manage your portfolio. And financial advisor, what we call financial advisors in Europe, are actually called financial planners in the US.
Uh-huh.
So you can actually use that term in the US and it makes sense. But as soon as you translate it into what we have here and the regulations we have here and what we define to be a financial advisor and what we define to be a discretionary investment manager, it all trips over. So I think that's, you know, that's where it came from, and that's why it is called what it is. But the way that we think about financial advice, it doesn't fit very well. But that's a bit of an aside.
The size are always much more interesting.
The second generation of robos, this is where we use technology not just to deliver the service element, but this is where we start to use technology to improve things like the investment methodology, to improve the investment strategy through individualization.
Okay, so let's just break this down then. So I entirely get the point, and of course you're completely correct, which is that if I go and buy the Fidelity Special Situations Fund, which I owned in the past, it did very nicely, I'm buying a product, and in that case it was a good deal. But of course, it's for me to decide that. When I hear you say service, then in my mind, it is really coming at this from the opposite direction, which are, you know, in extremis, what are Mike's financial needs? What does some dude who's mid-50s want to do with assets, when they're going to be used over what time scale and all that kind of stuff? Because that's my real problem. My problem isn't I didn't own the Fidelity Special Situations Fund, or maybe it is if it's going up at the moment. And I haven't seen much done on that over the years, although looking at Scalable's website, I did see that you've got nice cones out there, which from a risk perspective, I really like. It's a bit like the Bank of England inflation things. Giving a number is the only thing you know that's going to be wrong. So generally, and this is regulatory driven, there's this kind of mentality which says, oh, are you low, medium or high risk tolerance, which is, to me as a risk person, in extremis, utter nonsense, really. You know, because most people want lots of return for minimum risk, and you know, how do you define risk and all that kind of stuff. So if the fintech investment management market as a whole, and Nutmeg, Scalable, Betterment, Wealthfront, everybody, how do they approach this service thing then? Because to serve me, to tailor make a suit for me. You need to measure me up and have my measurements and then use the cloth and threads and all that kind of stuff to do it for me. So how is that actually done, given that, to be honest, I haven't seen it done well. I haven't done it completely properly anywhere. You can do better than a Marks & Spencer suit, for sure, but I haven't really seen anybody define these things. I mean, it's like pension funds. Let's take Shell's pension fund. How much should Shell's pension fund have in equities and debt? Well, I don't know, really. We can talk about it for quite a long time and, you know, reasonable men can differ. It's not like a finite state thing. It's not like 2 + 2 does equal 4, and it's not 5 or 3. So how do you approach this? How does the market approach this service element?
Sure. I actually think it is both elements. It's the trying to find someone's financial needs and work out a financial plan that works for their goals, their objectives. But the other part you mentioned, you know, picking the fund, and you said that, you know, you were able to go onto, it'll be some kind of platform, I assume, and you pick somebody's special situations.
I think it was called a telephone
fund.
In the past. The interweb didn't exist when I bought Fidelity Special Situations Fund.
But, you know, you've done a good job to pick that one. Most people get stuck there. You know, they go onto a website where they, you know, a fund supermarket website, and they have the choice of thousands and thousands
exactly.
of different
funds. It's overwhelming.
Funds. Yeah. They have absolutely no idea what to do. And even when they do pick something, it's usually a terrible choice because they've I like that fund manager. Oh, I've heard of that fund manager. And they haven't thought about their whole portfolio. I got a good example of a prospective client that came to a live event that we were holding in Canary Wharf, where we were explaining about what the scalable service does. And that's actually one thing that we try to do, get out in the real world and speak to clients. And he came up to me and he showed me a portfolio that he had online. And it had about 10 single names in there, you know, some emerging markets names, very high volatile stuff. And it was his whole life savings. And it was about 60, 70,000 when he invested, and now it was worth about 35,000. And he said to me, you know, what should I do with this? I couldn't give him any advice because I'm not an advisor, but I know for a fact that he shouldn't be doing what he's doing.
Yes, I mean, in terms of sort of family, I won't mention, but one member of the greater clan, poor lady, her husband passed away and he'd worked all his life for NatWest, and for some reason passed on the pension, which was all NatWest shares, and they got acquired by RBS. So, well, that was quite good. That was all going well. And then one day RBS had a bit of a problem and has been worth rather less ever since. And it's been terrible for her health,
yeah.
Sad to say. So one of the problems that we're all aware of in financial services is it can sound so abstract, because it is abstract. It doesn't really exist. It's kind of bits in a bank computer, really, a lot of this stuff. And it can sound so dull, but it literally can be the difference. Just using simple point there, like diversification, it can be the difference between living a healthy retirement, where you have lots of nice holidays, and yet health falling off the edge of the cliff because of the anxieties and stress caused by bad decisions. So it's really difficult to make it real to people, but it's absolutely the right thing to be focusing on. So one perspective on the fintech investment management, and I like your differentiation between the first wave and the second wave, and we'll get a little bit more into how the second wave can be more sophisticated than the first wave of, you know, democratization. Is that, and having been a fund manager for 8 years, I've carried my prejudices with me for quite a long time. A number of fintech investment managers or robo-advisors or what you want to call them, I see, are really just kind of, it's almost putting lipstick on a pig. They're taking an old model and tarting it up a bit, and it's online, oh, I can do it in my pocket now, rather than having to sort of trot round to, I don't know, Rothschilds or Rathbones or something and sort of see them a week Thursday. But they're not really doing anything to get over these fundamental problems of the fees over time will cripple you and that the sort of performance isn't very good.
Yeah, and I think that was the first wave. It was changing the customer journey, changing the distribution model, which is great because it meant that a lot more people got access, ultimately. You know, you could, and I totally get your point, you can go and buy a fund, but most people can't because they don't know what they're doing.
Well, most people don't is the more empirical point.
Exactly. Most people don't. It's far too confusing. So to basically say, look, I'm going to outsource it to this company. They've got a good reputation. It'll do everything for me. Is changing the game in terms of the starting point for a lot of people. So I can't take that away from the first wave. What I do believe is that the actual business model itself never really changed.
Yes, absolutely.
You go through an onboarding process.
Same pig, different lipstick.
You go through a great customer journey. You know, it's very clean, it's very easy, it's very accessible. But ultimately, what you get put in is one of 10 different model portfolios, which is exactly what I was saying that the private banks are typically doing as well. And it's all based on either the views of an individual or a team of individuals, which a lot of research is out there saying that it's flawed if you were to take that approach and you can't beat the index over the long term. You know, obviously, a lot about that type of stuff. And then you've got the other side of it, which is it's just very simple portfolios. It's just 10 different pools of assets, which are managed using investment theory, which was developed in the 1950s.
Yes, and I'm sure like me, but not like many people, you hear time and time again modern portfolio theory. Which...
when will it not be modern?
Exactly, that's my point. It continually makes me vomit because it was modern in 1950. 6 years later, it's modern. And the interesting thing is, I'm sure you read it, but next to nobody ever bothered to bloody read it. And the original paper by whatever his name, Horowitz and Thingamajig, is actually very simple. It's possible to read it. And they start by saying, let's take this simple model, which has got nothing to do with the real world whatsoever, and our conclusions won't really be that useful. And to cut a long story short, they get things like alpha and beta. And, you know, these things, but maybe not everybody in the audience does. And you read in newspapers now, you know, or In Search of Alpha or Smart Beta. And this is all based on something that was modern 60 years ago. And the author says, don't take this too seriously. It's only a fag packet.
Literally the opening paragraph. You know, the first time I read it, I couldn't believe it was there, but it's in broad daylight.
Exactly.
But the funny thing is, people even write that, you know, their investment models are based on Nobel Prize winning theories. But it's for theories which were developed in the 1950s. Yes, he won the Nobel Prize in the 1990s, but we're talking about something which is 65 years old. Older than what you could possibly imagine we can do now with the power of technology, scalability, data. And that's where the second wave of robo is going, using raw data to make smarter investment decisions, better models in terms of modeling the complexities of the financial world than could ever be possible by using a world which is based on modern portfolio theory.
Okay, so I get that theory. So let's unpack that then. So, you know, let's say that I get a windfall and suddenly I've got whatever it is you're going to tell me later, £10, £100, £1,000, £1,000,000 or whatever I need to stick it into your app or your website.
Just £10,000.
Just £10,000. Oh, round of drinks then, round of drinks. I've got that on me in cash. And so using all these clever people and professors and smart computers and yardy, 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 what is your claim about what you can do these days? What couldn't have been done 30 years ago?
Sure. So I'll start with the claims and then talk a little bit about the outcomes. So modern portfolio theory bases itself on the idea that returns are normally distributed, so that events happen with the same probability, both to the upside and to the downside, that when one thing goes down, it's not expected that all things go down at the same time, and also that events which happen in large magnitude happen very infrequently. Now, all three of those things are deeply flawed.
You don't need to be very old to have seen most of that torn apart.
Totally. So what you can do by using raw data is you can actually model the returns of the market in a much more realistic way. So instead of pretending that the markets move 5% once every millennium, we know that the markets move 5, 10% once every decade. So you can run simulations using things like cloud computing to be able to model the world in a much more realistic way.
So there, you're talking about, I don't know what words in your mouth, but are you talking about a more realistic modeling of how much investment risk I'm taking, as opposed to, oh, we can beat the market, quote unquote?
Exactly. It's much more about us being able to understand more about how the market really works in reality, to provide a portfolio which is in line with your risk tolerance, but also to give you a better understanding. Because what ultimately the output is of all of the smart modeling that we do in the background is a quantifiable measure of risk, which better defines the risk in your portfolio.
So what would that be then? Because I've taken to task for so long, and I've given up taking to task now because I got bored of it, the P2P industry. Because one of the things that the P2P industry does appallingly, or rather it doesn't do at all in the UK as far as I'm concerned, and there's online YouTube, some Lendit, where I'm moderating panels and asking leading players this, and they all duck the question. What they haven't done is define the risk. So if I give £10,000 to you, from what you say, I should actually get some pretty good feeling of how much I could lose if the shizer hits the fan. However, if I give £10,000 to Zopa, RateSetter, or Funding Circle, they don't give me any quantitative assessment.
Mm. Yeah.
It's absolutely mental.
Which is crazy, because the fundamental driver of return is risk.
Yes.
Else, the return wouldn't exist.
Yes. I mean, Funding Circle, I've got A's, B's, C's, D's, E's, and whatever. And the riskier you get, the more return you get. So it's all about, how much can I prepare to lose? Well, 10 grand, I don't want to lose a grand, or I don't mind losing 5 grand. Or I don't mind losing 10 grand, or stick it all in crowdfunding, or buy 10,000 one-hand shares, or something
like
that.
So then bring that into the wealth management world, or the investment management world, where usually you would get in a portfolio which has a label like medium risk.
Yes.
You know, that's what they're told. Hey, this portfolio has medium risk.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever that means. And what it means to me might be completely different to what it means to you.
Yes.
And then you have the other alternative to that, which is you're in the 5 out of 10. What does that mean?
I haven't even heard that one.
Or, you know, you're in a portfolio which is rated 5 and you can go all the way from 1 to 10.
Oh, I see.
All that's telling you is that over the long run, you're going to have generally less risk in your portfolio than somebody has the 7. And you'll have a bit more risk than someone that has a 3.
Yes.
So for us, we want to try and provide our clients with a better understanding of how much risk is in their portfolio.
Yes. And of course, the way to do this, and which is why these numbers are wrong, is these numbers assume that risk is an absolute thing. It's not an absolute thing. Apart from the fact you worked at Goldman Sachs. I mean, you know, if you hadn't worked at Goldman Sachs and therefore been infinitely wealthy already, then you might, as a relatively young gentleman, be thinking about buying a house. And the average person in London is, what, 39 or 40 buying their first house. Yep. And let's say they want to buy it sort of before the year's out. So their risk is anything that, if they need it in 6 months' time, could have gone down a lot. So they should be sticking in cash. Equally, if said person's worked at Goldman Sachs, then they've probably got a mansion already and they don't want to buy another one, in which case they think, oh, I need to stick some aside for my retirement and my kids' school fees in case my wonderful startup doesn't actually sort of fly as high as it might do, in which case they'd be taking a massive amount of risk by just leaving it in cash because, by and large, demonstrably, equities tend to go up over 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
And just to be clear, that was just a hypothetical person that you were describing there.
Oh, absolutely, yes, yes. I wasn't looking at you at all. The fact I was looking at you was a mere coincidence.
What's important, though, is when thinking about risk, is that everybody has an individual risk tolerance. And as soon as you breach that, as soon as you lose, and it could be for me, 20% of the value of my portfolio, I'm going to get out. And I'm going to sit on the sidelines for years. And I'm going to get back in when things are better, when things are much higher. And I'm going to underperform just staying invested. But everybody has a completely different tolerance to whatever that level would be.
Yes, I try not to use the word risk tolerance in this because the word risk is so misused. I think of it more as a pain threshold.
Yeah.
So I was talking to a very grown-up organization the other day about this point. And going back to having been the first sort of risk in the city in the 1990s, when there weren't so many computers around, all that kind of thing, you had to come up with some relatively simple way of communicating risk budgets to the board. And one of the ones which worked extremely well and could be translated into anything you wanted was something I called a DDNL, Daily Downside Notification Level, which is that you're running equities, say. And in terms of the board perspective, I say, okay, then, Adam, you're running the equities, the business. On a bad day, in this context, do we define bad as happening once a month, how much might you lose? A million? 10 million? 100 million? A billion? I mean, you know, that really gives you some immediate feeling against, like, the fixed income division or between Goldman's and Bank of America or Morgan Stanley or all these other ones. So some simple thing like that, and it was really kind of a pain threshold. And going back to investment management, I did some work once for investment trusts, and it was the same kind of thing. And I said to the chap running investment trust, I said, well, put it this way, if you went to a board meeting and you'd lost X percent, and you'd walk in there thinking, oh, I'm not looking forward to this meeting, they're going to hate that, what does the X mean?
Yeah.
Gave me, I think it was 10% actually. I then showed that they were running far more risk than that, demonstrably.
Sure. So we think about it in exactly the same way. So I think what you were describing is what we call value at risk. So we try to define the bad case scenario in terms of a percentage. And we put people in a portfolio which is their pain threshold. So it runs from 3% all the way up to 25%. And what it's telling you is that in a really bad year, you might lose 15% or more. And really bad year is defined quantitatively as one in every 20 years. So 95% of the time, you shouldn't experience a loss which is of that magnitude, which is 15% or more.
Yes, the reason I disconnect the pain threshold and use non-technical language like that from value at risk, and this will end up being a nerd fest and the podcast will go on forever, is precisely this: the fact that markets aren't normal. That back when I had people doing systems for me, we bought every system going, some in Germany and some in the UK. That's a coincidence, isn't it? And they calculated value at risk. So, you know, then people are saying, oh, well, 3 standard deviations is 99.5 or whatever it is. That's bollocks. No, it's not at all, because the shit hits the fan, as you say, with great regularity, black swans, yada, yada, yada.
Totally agree. Sorry to nerd it up again. Value at risk for me is the thermometer. And how you calculate it is the difference between Fahrenheit and Celsius. And you can use a normal distribution to define your 95% confidence interval, or you could use raw data. So we use value at risk. So we use the measurement tool, which provides us with the worst 5% of outcomes. But we don't power it by throwing in the normal distribution. We power it with the raw data itself. and therefore don't have to rely on the assumptions of the normal distribution.
Yes, and going at a tangent to a tangent, we should be playing ping pong here, at a tangent to a tangent, Lord Turner, when he was on the show talking about how Basel III came along and when regulation went off the rails, he said that financial regulation globally went off the rails when they started to allow people to do internal models approval and calculate their own capital themselves. And I did go to a meeting 20 years ago where there's a ping pong, a bit like this one, between then the head of derivatives at Kleinwort's and the Bank of England, where they were talking about how you calculate numbers. And once you've done that, it's become subjective. And I think the last time I saw some Basel tests on this or something, that given the same portfolio to leading Wall Street players, so even in one culture, they varied in their calculations by a factor of 10. Anyway, going back to keep it simple, stupid, you stick your mum in something, how much does she not want to lose X?
Yeah.
Somehow.
Exactly.
Somehow.
And we can't guarantee it, because in capital markets, you can't guarantee everything. You know, everything can go to zero, but it's a very, 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 very unlikely event.
Yes, yes. Okay, so talking of waves, having been at a beach a little while ago, you get one wave come in and then you get another, and actually there's another wave behind that. So how do you see all this evolving going forwards?
So I think this comes back to what you were asking earlier, which is why has nobody really done a good job at providing the full financial plan? And I think a big enabler for this is PSD2. So once firms like ours can get access to the whole of life financial picture for our clients, then we have a great opportunity to make sure that the investments that they hold with our firm fit into the big picture. And being able to see, you know, money coming in, pulling money in on in a smart way so that they're allocating their capital to the investment markets when they have been paid a bonus, for example. Or if they've got heavy outgoings because it's in the run-up to Christmas, we can make sure that we're getting money back into their current account. That's where this whole thing is going. And the second wave, I think, which we're in right now, I think is showing the power of technology. But we're really not there yet. I think what comes next, the next couple of years of innovation, is what really excites me and will really show the differences between the traditional investment management world and the technology-driven new entrants and incumbent players who actually properly invest in this space as well.
Interesting. I hadn't connected PSD to an investment management. And to be fair, I slightly stitched you up by starting with investment management and talking about it moving online, because as you point out correctly, that's a kind of a product thing. And I don't think the service necessarily needs to be massively sophisticated. It doesn't really matter how your black boxes calculate things inside the black box, as long as actually your mum finds out that over 10 years it's been roughly right, and only once did she sort of get a bath and the other 9 years she didn't, then that's fine. But at a very simple level, and fintech often works well by being simple, one of the services, not a product, but one of the services you can do for people, me included, is take away the I have to do something to invest money bit. Because do you know what? That goes on my to-do list, along with a million other things, along with sort of, you know, the leaky tap in the kitchen. Oh yeah, I must get around to doing that. And going back to Legal & General, I do recall 1 year where I completely missed the whole year. So I lost that tax capacity for then and forevermore. So there is a value, even if you're taking sort of one penny out of my account every day or whatever it is.
And then think about the future world where, because we're dealing with individual accounts, it's a product or a service of mass customization, where we can take into account things like your capital gains tax allowances.
Yes, this is one of the facts I'd heard about why IM hasn't been disrupted, because everybody's got capital gains, and therefore if they transfer the money from one place to another, what's the way around that, or there isn't?
With some things you can do that. Obviously, if you've got ISAs and SIPs, totally fine. But yeah, there's a lot of things where you'll end up crystallizing tax. But at the end of the day, taxes need to be paid. and you shouldn't do an investment just for the sake of tax.
Yes, I've heard that, absolutely. And it is generally true, although, again, we all know plenty of people who will pay their taxes but postpone the day until they did it.
Yeah.
I had a BES investment in the 90s, which was a sort of forerunner of these EIS schemes or whatever we had now, which I pretty much sort of forgot about.
You're not telling us about a tax avoidance scheme that you participated in?
No, this is the government's tax avoidance scheme, actually, and it had lots of tax benefits. And anyway, I put some money and forgot about it. And then I got called the other day, which actually, it might be worth quite a lot of money. Well, that's quite nice. So I thought, well, that's quite nice. So I started wondering what type of Aston Martin I might want to buy myself, second-hand, of course. But then sort of the penny dropped, thought, oh, hang on, I didn't have any tax losses at the moment. I have to pay a huge chunk of that away in capital gains tax, which has changed format about a million times since I had it. So we'll come on to scalable capital a little now. We've touched on about, you know, the market and occasionally sort of touched on you, but let's focus a little bit more on scalable in a second. But before we get to that point, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there, particularly all of those that didn't fall asleep during Adam and my ping pong around, how do you calculate risk? I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple, transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. So, Adam, just wrapping up about Scalable, so we've touched on it off and on. Can you just give us a little sort of thumbnail overview of key stuff about where you've been, where you are and where you're going, with particular emphasis in terms of where you are and where you're going, over which of the millions of listeners to the podcast — it's gone up since last time. Last time it was only thousands, now it's millions. Which of the millions of listeners might like to check you guys out?
Sure. So we launched our businesses in Germany and the UK about a year ago. And since then, we've grown to about 4,000 clients and about £150 million of assets under management. So if you're interested in getting your wealth managed and you're based in the UK or Germany, please go and check us out. You know, just Google Scalable Capital and you'll find us. What's been really interesting when we set the business up was we offer a direct-to-consumer proposition. And if you go to our website, that's what you can see. But since we launched, we've had pretty much every single major financial institution come in and meet us. We've had asset managers, insurers, banks, private banks, wealth managers, looking to see how we might be able to help them solve a problem. So one deal which we've announced is that we're actually powering Siemens employee benefits platform in Germany for their wealth management needs. And that's a deal that we were really proud of. And not only is it one of Germany's biggest employers, which is great access to the right type of people for us, but it was a deal that we won against the incumbent industry. So we were pitching against, you know, the old guard of the financial world, and they decided that they wanted to partner with us, which is a startup, is great. But we're also working on a pipeline of other deals. So I would say if you work for a financial institution who has a problem with regards to offering cost-effective wealth management, investment management solutions to your clients in any country around the world, because we have global ambition, then, you know, drop us a line. Because I'm pretty sure with the modular approach to how we had to build everything to do Germany and UK and be, you know, multi-country from day one, we can potentially help you as well.
Okay, so that's nice and clear. So I think what I hadn't picked up on, although I did see the Siemens logo, and clearly the German CEO has more feathers in his cap than the UK CEO, so I hope the UK CEO will also have some feathers in his cap to announce as the year goes by. But I hadn't particularly got my head around the fact that you're B2C and B2B, although it's very interesting in terms of the zeitgeist in 2017 that I'm hearing that more and more fintechs are having approaches and conversations with incumbents. I like the what you're talking about here about sort of the first wave and second wave, because rather like Benjamin Sisko in Deep Space Nine, who got stuck in the time when his spaceship blew up and his wife got crushed or something. I've got a little bit sort of stuck in my own fintech investment management pigeonhole in terms of this conference we were at in 2015.
Probably because we shared a room with a Russian guy who wouldn't shut up.
Yes, I'd fortunately blocked that out of my mind, actually, but that's a comeback. But it's kind of, as you put it, the over-democratization or the sort of just naivety of the, in some cases, of the first wave. Lots of people don't have money. I'm very sad. I wish they did. Lots of them don't have it. For the others, they can just buy a little bit of unit trust. The kind of service that you're providing in the old world or in the new world is best aimed at a certain amount of money, certain critical mass that makes it cost effective. Outside that cost effectiveness band, you're running into problems which the first wave had. The second wave is coming along, and as you say, the third wave is going to be different, and I hadn't connected it to PSD2 in my own mind, but increasingly I'm starting to get the feel of a world that John Kay, who is the most downloaded podcast of all time, was talking about, in which financial services as a whole, old and new, is really there to look after individuals and companies over their life cycle. And they're not just being flogged products anymore, but they're being taken care of. So thank you for that insight. I shall definitely remember that one going away. And anybody who's interested in this thing, I'm sure you'll find that Scalable Capital has got lots on their website and you can make up your own mind. So thank you very much, Adam, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit and abandon our Watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.